We've got one final bonus podcast for you this year as the Formula Scout team debates and discusses all about the top 50. As you may or may not know, the top 50 is our end of year feature where we, well, essentially talk about the top 50 drivers of the year from all of the various different categories, with new faces coming in and champions and lots and lots of controversial near misses as well. So to talk about some of those near misses, as well as some of the more contentious placements among the debatings that we've had among the Formula Scout team, we're going to discuss all about all the various drivers, and there will be some spoilers coming ahead, so do make sure you read the five-part feature before you listen, unless you do want to be spoiled, of course, in which case, don't. So we've got a full house, five of us here this evening: Roger, myself, Alejandro, Bethany, and Ida as well. So I think really I'm going to throw it over to Ida first to sort of just explain generally how the top 50 works and how it's come about and why we even do a top 50.
We've been doing it since 2011, so the very start of Formula Scout, and it's essentially a way of, you know, we do a lot of season reviews for a lot of series, and we do rank the drivers, but it's a way of bringing all of our paddock knowledge, acknowledging all the series that took place, and basically reminding ourselves and the readers of everything that's happened in the year by using this format of going, these are the 50 best drivers, this is what they got up to, and to say what they're going to do next year, because quite a lot of them, though they haven't announced things, we can tease essentially their 2022 plans. The way we do it is everyone on the editorial team is open to vote for it, and we literally just cast our top 50 drivers in order, and once we've all kind of settled on that, we then put them in a spreadsheet, and we use pretty much every form of averaging you have, so median, mean, mode. We use those kinds of barometers to then set the order, in addition to setting just a pure average as well. Once we've got that list, we then chuck it back at all of ourselves and go, do we agree with this statistical list, and are there any kind of contentious positions? Because, for example, if someone's put a driver in 10th place and everyone else has put them in 49th, their average is going to be skewed by that one result, and therefore you have to think about where most of the votes are going rather than just a singular vote, while also considering, if that person thinks this driver's good, they're probably the best person to write that entry. And we do that for every single driver. And then when we get to the top 10, that's the most important one of them all, because that's going to be probably something you put on your mantelpiece if you're a driver. You'll screenshot the article and go, I was in the top 10 that year. So that's the plan there. And that is obviously coming out on the final day of the year. So a great way to cap off 2021.
Yes, certainly. And as you may or may not remember, it was Yuki Tsunoda who was our number one pick last year after a fantastic debut year in Formula 2, off of a pretty tough one to sort of debate, really. And Tsunoda succeeded Robert Schwartzman, who was the FIA 3 champion. So it isn't always necessarily the Formula 2 champion who necessarily is the number one pick. Formula 2 is, of course, going to be top of our hierarchy, if you will, with FIA F3 just behind. But there are loads and loads of different championships, and how we sort of evaluate different championships compared to certain others may be a little bit surprising and a little bit contentious in its own right as well. But I guess talking about contention, we should start talking about some drivers in particular. And I think the biggest sort of debate that we've got going on literally as we record this podcast at the moment is deciding who our runner-up spot is going to be. If you've been paying attention to our content throughout this year, probably isn't going to be a huge surprise who the number one spot is going to go to, but the number two spot is certainly an interesting debate at the moment. We've got two names in particular, Dennis Auger and Teo Pourchaire, who are right up there in the frame over that. So I guess it's time to bring in Alejandro, because it's been a while since we've spoken to Alejandro on a podcast. So This is one that, like I say, is ongoing at the moment, and there are lots of fors and against it in both situation in both circumstances. But where do you stand on the Hauger versus Porcher debate?
Yeah, well, first of all, hello everyone. As you just said, I'm back after a while. And it's a very difficult decision to make, to be honest, because on the one hand, you have Theo Pourchaire, who's inexperienced in Formula 2, and then on the other hand, you've got Dennis Hauger, who has been fantastic all the year long and in Formula 3, but who has already a season of experience and was also driving for Prema. So it's very difficult to pick one of them. But I'd say Pourchaire stays ahead of Hauger in my opinion, because he delivered in almost every grand. The ART wasn't as strong as in the past, so I think he really deserves to be a runner up this year.
And I want to bring in Bethany here to add to this one as well. The Hauger versus Porsche over P2 debate. We've heard certainly a strong case for Porsche, but where are you at on this one?
When I first wrote my thing, I put Hauger pretty far down, but then as we've had this discussion, he's been growing up and up and up. I think one of the best things about what Hauger's done this year is how he's managed the championship. We've talked a lot about how the format is and whether we like it or not, but that's what the format was. And if you wanted to be F3 champion, I feel like it's important for drivers to be able to manage the series format, whether that's qualifying first and then winning, like in Formula One or like Formula E's over the past couple of years, having that mixed-up qualifying. And Hauger really managed that, which I think is really it was probably one of his strongest points for the season. And in a se I really value series where winning, you don't just qualify well and then win. So that's been why I've not really hated this year's format as much as others. And I think Hauger doing that has kind of given him the edge over the likes of Porsche and other drivers who haven't really been able to shine so much over the full weekend in the same way he has.
Yeah, certainly. I'm on the Porsche P2 side of things. I know that we've had a little bit of stick for talking too much about Monaco, but I mean that was just one of the best weekend performances by a driver this year. I think in general. So that's my stance on it. But I guess we should move on a little bit now because, if you've been reading, keeping up with the stuff that's come up until today, and you haven't read the last part yet, you'll recognize that a certain Road to Indy driver has not been mentioned yet. So I want to come to Ida here because we've both championed Indy Lights drivers, or Indy Lights champions, being in the top 10 for the past, well, couple of years, not last year, of course, because the championship didn't run. But last, well, you know, the last couple certainly deserve to make the top 10. It hasn't quite happened before, but finally we can confirm that we've got an Indy Lights champion in the top 10 somewhere. So why is Kyle Kirkwood's placement perhaps going to be a little bit contentious, do you think?
Well, I think it isn't as contentious as previous editions. You know, Pato Ward coming 11th when he won Indy Lights, that was very, very contentious. But Kirkwood is basically the Road to Indy GOAT. He's won more than anyone else. He has won pretty big as well. I think that 22nd victory he had this year at Laguna Seca is unmatched in like the modern era of Indy Lights. We haven't really seen that kind of domination, at least in a dry race with like all normal conditions. and he was basically in the strongest Indy Lights field in terms of car count for the last 5 years. So he had the hardest challenge to win the Indy Lights title of anyone we've seen recently. But historically, Indy Lights is, even though it's the step below IndyCar, we don't consider it as highly as F2. So you could argue Kirkwood winning the equivalent of F2 should be in first or second place, because he did it as a rookie as well. But at the same time, he was only against like eight other full-time cars, and he was challenged very closely by David Malukas. So a bit of contention over where we're going to put him in that top 10. But he is in the top 10. That's the important thing. He did such a good job this year that there was no argument to rule him out of that.
Yeah, certainly. And depending on how you sort of interpret things as well, the Andretti package may not necessarily have been the strongest package as well, which certainly goes in Kirkwood's favour. His Malukas has made it, you know, quite highly on the list as well this year. So it does seem like the strength of Indy Lights this year has been showcased with placements in the top 10, and we've got three Indy Lights drivers that have made the top 50 this year, which is almost certainly one more than has been the case the past few years. Well, definitely in 2020, because there weren't any. Let's move swiftly on. I want to go to Roger, because not only have we got an Indy Lights champion making the top 10, but we've also got a Formula 4 driver making the top 10. Now, this is a very, very rare occurrence indeed, and I think perhaps even possibly the first occurrence of such a situation. But what Ollie Bearman did this year was quite remarkable. Obviously, you know, the record, you know, what he's been achieving this year, the runs that he went on, the streaks that he went on were quite something. So we don't necessarily class Formula 4 quite as strongly as the more senior championships, if you will, but for him to come along and do what he did certainly justifies a top 10 placement, doesn't it?
Yes, I agree. I mean, we spoke on the previous podcast quite a lot about Ollie Bearman and how difficult it is, or how important it is to win both the German and the Italian titles. I think probably we're all agreed that he was the standout Formula 4 driver of the last season. I think I was also looking, as you said, I don't think we've had a Formula 4 driver in the top 10, and we've just talked about Hauger and Porsche. I think they were sort of low 20s in their season. So being top 10 is probably a first for Formula 4. But I think you have to say, taking the two titles together with the effort that goes into that, and I mean, a very, very strong field, I think, particularly in Italy, maybe some few more question marks over the German championship, which probably wasn't as strong as in the Porsche Hauger year. But I guess with all the Formula 4 drivers, you look back two or three years later to establish, you know, how strong really was that field. And that sort of 2019 field that Porsche and Hauger drove against turns out to be quite a strong one. And we'll find out the strength of the competition that Bearman had. But I don't think you can knock the performance, and you know, just the 17 wins, I think, plus one in GB3 is an outstanding record, and I think the top 10 is thoroughly deserved.
Mm-hmm, certainly. And to Ida, how tricky was it to place a Formula 4 driver in the top 10 this year, given the previous form of not necessarily having one in there?
It is pretty tricky. It is helped by the fact that, like, FIA Formula 3 in Italian F4 has like 36 cars a lot of the time. So you can never really complain that there wasn't the competition there for Bearman to go up against. And in ADAC F4, we did actually see the grid go down to 8 cars, but that was the best 6 drivers there, and they were mostly his teammates and Tim Tramnitz at US Racing's teammates. So one of the things we always take into equation here is, how do you do against your teammates? He wiped the floor clean with them, and Teo Porcher did the same, similarly did to Kyle Kirkwood. So on that metric alone, he equaled or bettered those other drivers on the higher formulas. And when you're at F4, it's a harder job to do to, you know, detonate the rest of the field, because you simply don't have the racecraft and the experience to know how to do it usually. But Behrmann, with a, you know, a lot of support from his engineer Rick at Van Amersfoort, and pretty good engines until they got disqualified at Imola, which is still, I believe, under contention, a bit like the Freck race as well. He could have won like a record number of races on the bounce. And we did a feature at the time when he did that and looked at every other top level F4 series and F3 series, and no one's done anything like that. It's pretty much unheard of. So pretty much the most dominant F4 performance we've seen since the category was created. In its FIA form back in 2014.
Yeah, so I think if there was ever going to be a year that an F4 driver was going to make the top 10, this was almost certainly going to be that year in particular. So certainly very, very good stuff from Oli Biermann, certainly justifying of his Ferrari placement and spot on the Aston Martin Autosport BRDC award finalist as well. So really good from him. One driver who narrowly missed out on the top 10, literally at the last minute, was none other than Dan Ticktum, who's placed in 11th. Probably can be a little bit contentious placement. I know he's got plenty of fans in many places who probably would have thought that he would likely squeeze into the top 10. So Alejandro Ticktum just outside of the top 10. We felt, you know, really it was justified, especially to make way for a driver like Biermann. What did you make of that one?
Well, I don't know. He was inside my top 10. I think he was actually 10th. I cannot remember well, but the thing is that you could have probably expected more from Ticktum in terms of performance in future races. I mean, I expected more from him in terms of perhaps getting one or two future race wins, and he didn't. So that's probably why he was dropped, allowing Biermann to go in. Whereas, if you allow me to say it, I say that Biermann in the top 10 is very much deserved, because he performed at the best level possible there. He did his job, and whether you've got competition or not, you have to perform. At the end of the day, that's what you have to do to give your best, and I think he did it. But going back to Ticktum, as I said, he was experienced. He had a good car. I mean, we've seen he has come through the field quite a few times, so the pace was there, and the Rubala was also doing good races most of the time. So yeah, he narrowly misses out of the top 10, but I don't think it's a problem, because, you know, at the end you've got to see the overall picture, and despite there have been many great performances from him this year, he lacked a bit at the end.
Yeah, for sure. So like after that, for a while, I wouldn't say there are too many contentious placements on the list, particularly among ourselves. Perhaps possibly Gregor Sorsi being sort of in the mid-teen somewhere, whereas Euro Cup champions have placed a little bit higher in the past. But I think that it's a little bit difficult to necessarily impress too much, I think, in that field this year. It's certainly difficult to justify moving him a little bit higher up the order. But going a little bit further down, I've got Tepe Nettori written down as a driver to discuss. And I'm going to go to Ida again, our Japan expert, for all of those early morning races that I daren't even consider waking up for. But just outside of the top 30, possibly slightly contentious. So explain to the listeners why that's the case.
Yeah, so essentially I covered, I think, every round of Super Formula Lights this year. And I believe I was the only one who didn't actually put Nettori in the top 50 with my vote. So he did, it's his third year at this kind of level. He did Euro Formula in 2019 and FIA Formula 3 as a Honda Junior. Then he did Super Formula Lights last year with Toda Racing. So I think they still had the self-developed engine last year, which wasn't particularly quick. Then he was at BMX this year, and he won the title, which is, you know, it's impressive. It's basically equivalent of winning the Euro Formula title, or if you look at it in a slightly different way, it's the equivalent of winning Formula 2, because Super Formula Lights feeds directly into Super Formula. But for the last 6-7 years, we've seen that series be dominated, utterly crushed by the likes of Sasha Fenestraz, Shou Tsuboi, lots of drivers have gone up to Super Formula. And the way Nettori did it, he did not dominate it at all. The few races he did win, yeah, they were handy margins, but it's really hard to overtake in Japan. And the Dallara 320 is a high downforce car, so that makes it difficult as well. And then I think the last point is, at the end of the year, he already knew he had no chance to go to Super Formula. His racecraft got messy. There was a clash with Giuliano Alesi in the season finale. So the title was essentially decided on that, which is pretty dire if you're going to think of how high up the level this series is. But as far as I understand, he might actually be moving to Formula 2 with Trident. He did the post-season test with his sponsor Buzz Racing, which previously invested in Carlin and invested in BMAX's Super Formula program. And now it looks like they're going to take that money and put it into Formula 2. But we did put Giuliano Alesi in the top 50 as well. I didn't put either of them in there, because Alesi had done several years of F2 as well. But it's in the same way that if you look at like the Formula 2 drivers and that argument we just had there with Tictum, it's like you can't have a series this high level and not have the champion in the top 50. But with hundreds of drivers who did well this year, I thought he just didn't quite make the cut to especially if not necessarily on results, but you know, who's impressed you the most? The 50 most impressive drivers. I don't think he was in that top 50. But in the placing he was put, I've written something that hopefully, you know, presents a decent argument on that front.
Yeah, for sure. And some of us wrote like what we like to call a long list of drivers before we came into having the top 50. And I don't know about anyone else, but I had 107 drivers on my list as possible drivers to make the list. Quite a few that I want to learn a little bit more about, and a few that I was a little bit unsure of, but they might have just squeezed into the top 50 somewhere. But it was very difficult to whittle it down from 107 down to just 50, I can assure you that much. One driver with several years of experience at Formula 2 level who has made it into the top 50 is Ralph Bochong, who is a new entry after all of these years. He's squeezed into the top 50. And given just how many years he's been at this level and the fact that he's taken just two podiums this year, it could be considered a bit contentious in a way. But I'm going to come to Alejandro here to get some thoughts on Ralph Bochong, because I think you're probably the only person I haven't actually asked about Bochong in the past few weeks, because we've been talking quite a lot about the Swiss driver lately.
Yeah, definitely. I don't know what to say. I mean, he was good. The thing is that for me, because from all the top 50 that were submitted, I think I was the one who placed him in the lowest position. But I think that he could have given even more. I mean, I'll explain myself. I think he had extraordinary qualifying performances. He was in the top 7 in 6 out of 8 round, so that was very impressive. I wasn't expecting that, especially after the beginning of the year there in Bahrain, where he was aiming top 10 and then he qualified, I think it was P12, and it was a bit of a disappointment. But Then they worked very hard, and now they work very, very hard in Barcelona test, and they turned things around. And qualifying was actually very good set for Silverstone. But the thing is that they were lacking a bit in the races, and then he made quite a few mistakes in Monza and Sochi, which I think were quite harsh on him towards the final standings, because I think that very important points were missed there because due to those mistakes. But yeah, it's definitely a very much deserved top 50 spot, because as you know, the team faced a very difficult season with the passing of Adrian at the beginning of the year. And so the fact that they were able to turn things around after a very difficult beginning of the season, and then with many drivers sharing the car number 20, it's not an ideal situation, but he was able to focus on his job and to extract the best out of the car and score some very good results.
Mm-hmm, for sure. And it's come to Roger for a final word on Ralph Boschong for 2021. P39, certainly quite a deserving placement for him, don't you think?
Well, I have to admit, I don't think I had him in my top 50 at all. I definitely agree with what Alejandro said. I think to me, 2021 was kind of the year of the comeback, that there were so many drivers in so many formulas that bounced back from disappointing years or have been around and suddenly put in not really a breakthrough performance, but it sort of suddenly clicked or it got back. I definitely would give him credit for carrying the team, as Alejandro said. I think he did a team leader's role in seeing that team through and really progressing towards the end of the season without much with a rotation of drivers in the second seat. But so I think I was swayed by the arguments. I can see the top 50 spot, but it's probably not a driver that you would look out for as the sort of electrifying results that sort of stand out every weekend. But maybe while we're on Swiss drivers, you sort of skipped over Grégoire Saucy. Maybe just a quick comment. Again, someone that has been around for some time, like Boschong. But I think we said, smashing your teammates out of the ground. I think he clearly walked all over his teammates, including very highly rated rookie in Gabriele Mini, and I think the field was quite strong. So to take 8 wins in that field is a strong performance, whatever lies behind it. So I would go into bat slightly for Saucy's position.
Mm-hmm. Yes, for sure. I suppose we should talk about Cameron Das, and I wonder who the person would be perfect to talk about Cameron Das is. Let's go to our Euroformula expert, Ida. P40 for Das. The placement of the Euroformula drivers was pretty contentious across the board, I think, with Das being around for quite a while and eventually taking the title. Louis Foster placing quite highly, and neither of those two being the highest placed Euroformula driver of the lot.
Yeah, we put Jack Crawford as our highest Euroformula driver, which I think maybe like 3 of us did that, and 2 of us didn't even put Das and Foster in the top 50 at all. So Das was, I think it was his 57th start when he won the season opener, so he's been around in the series since 2017. And then he won all 3 races then, but that happened so long ago, it was quite easy to forget. And then we came to the rest of the season, and it was super, super close fight with The two other drivers in the most park stable, Foster and Crawford. And we've done a feature on that showing how small that gap was, because it was way closer than it sometimes looked. Our one weekend where Crawford just swept the floor. But yeah, it was difficult to place them because of that experience, and because you had drivers like Roman Stanek who came in for Imola, and he was just on the pace straight away. He'd never seen that car before, and he was rivaling Crawford and ahead of Das, who did have chassis damage, but all in, it contributed to this kind of, he lucked it, not necessarily lucked into the title, but he got it for experience. He didn't go out there trying to win every race like Grégoire Saucy did. He went out there just to get the points, just to build on the big tally he'd got at the start of the season. And that made the actual title less impressive, which is generally what we're looking for. We're looking for drivers to impress us, which he didn't really do. Foster got wiped out three races as well, so we didn't really see his true, how close he was to Das. And I think in the end, because I pay so much attention to Euro Formula, because I'm in the paddock every weekend, it kind of gives everyone else the opportunity to not focus on that series as much, because I've got it under control. So then when everyone else came to their top 50, they're like, oh, I don't actually know where to put Das. Whereas I had like a really bang on, like, I know what was like behind the scenes. I know how much work he put into setup development and stuff. So I could place him, I thought, fairly accurately. And other drivers, I was a bit like, oh, well, I wasn't in that paddock, so I wouldn't know. But in the end, and this is actually like for the third year in a row, I haven't been the person who's put the Euro Formula champion highest. It's been someone else. So I'm almost good at marking down those drivers rather than marking them up. And I think this year I marked him fairly well, but on the averages of the statistics, he was very, very low. And we had to kind of argue that the gaps weren't that substantial on track, and therefore we should put them closer in our top 50.
Mm. Yeah, certainly. Very, very interesting one indeed. And I think the final really sort of contentious one is the very first driver on the list, actually, P50, and that is Jamie Chadwick, W Series champion for the second time, but perhaps a little bit less impressive than her first, but I certainly made the argument that the opposition was it came along a lot stronger than what it did in the start of 2019, some with a bit more experience, and some up-and-coming drivers looking quite handy as well. So we haven't chatted to Bethany for a little while. So Chadwick P50, we had to squeeze her in there, and we just about did it. She could have been usurped by a couple of other W Series drivers, couldn't she?
Yeah, I think, first of all, it goes to show how big W Series is, because last year we had zero female drivers, now we have one, so maybe if next year we have two female-only series, we'll have two female drivers in our top 50. But Chadwick, I think it's a mixture of her having been in Formula Regional level championship for what feels like ages now, and the fact that even though she had a championship challenger this year, it was again another really experienced driver that was really why she didn't get higher up in the list, especially compared to other series at that level. It's kind of got to the point where we're all expecting more from Jamie Chadwick now, and hopefully that's something that's coming in the near future. But right now, she would really, if you're going to redo a series, you've got to blow everyone out of the water. If you've won it, the only way you can go is backwards when you redo a series. So I think all in all, Chadwick just didn't do enough to impress compared to so many of the talented drivers, and I think the same kind of went for Alice Powell. And even though Alice's experience is in other non-single-seater series, so that stepped W Series was really something. It's just their experience now, you'd expect more from them. That's not to say because of their age you'd expect more from them, it's purely their experience in cars. So I think that's why Jamie's where she is, and hopefully she can do great things in Formula 3, and hopefully we'll see more W Series drivers higher up the ranks in the future. But right now, we just really need to see some Formula regional level drivers doing well in W Series, which isn't what we've had so far.
For sure. I think ultimately it sort of comes down to we just don't really know how good the W Series field is. And if we have more indications in the future that the field is actually really, really good, with a lot of drivers moving on to other championships, be it professional ones or other junior single seater ones, then we'll have a lot more more reason to place more W Series drivers on the list, perhaps in the very near future. But we just don't really sort of know at this point, because it is a field that's largely filled up with journey women, if you will, and a few drivers with sort of middling results in Formula 4 coming up through the ranks as well. So we just don't really quite know just how strong the field is. So I think having a W Series driver on the list is certainly important, not least because it is a regional level championship, and we've got other regional level championships with one driver. We've got some even with zero on the list, and we'll come to one of those shortly. But it is certainly, I think 50th is fine for Chadwick, and I sort of squeezed her in my own list, like right at the bottom as well. But you've mentioned Abby Pulling, but Alice Powell was championed by Ida to make the list. We'll see with the near future on that one. But suppose we should talk about some near misses now. We've already sort of touched on Abby Pulling and Alice Powell. There were two drivers who could have replaced Chadwick, sort of at that very lower end of the top 50. I suppose Pulling's difficult British F4 campaign really sort of brought her down in that regard, if she'd started that one off a bit stronger, than perhaps there was a chance that she could have squeezed in. And I suppose with Powell, whilst Ida very rightly brought up the point that she was incredibly strong in race pace, and when it came to overtaking and technical nous and so forth, she is certainly quite a little bit older, if you will, a lot more experienced with these with junior single seaters and with other cars as well. So a little bit more difficult to place on the list, and with the regional car as well, it is so important to qualify well. And Chadwick was just able to pull out some brilliant laps out of the bag in that regard. But the first driver I really want to sort of bring up is Christian Mansell. He's a very funny character, is Mansell. Ida is given a good shake of the head. So I suppose now's a good time to come to Ida to talk a little bit about Mansell and explain why he just missed out on a top 50 spot.
Yeah, Christian Mansell is basically if Daniel Ricciardo and Alex Pironi had a love child. He's just like this big, grinny Australian kid who has like a no fucks given attitude and is really open to basically just learning anything, which is why when he jumped into Euro Formula this year, he adapted very quickly. Admittedly, on his first weekend, he did have Dan Tixum as basically his engineer, or like his assistant engineer, and that made him get up to speed very, very quickly, because Tixum basically did the development work for the Dallara 320. But in GB3 as well, he was just like, because he only did British F4 last year, stepped up, did a brilliant job, then also did a brilliant job in Euro Formula, but he just didn't win enough, really. You know, he wasn't doing the dominant things that some of his rivals were, but he was just getting the job done, essentially, in everything he did. And when you've got so many regional level series and GB3, which isn't a regional series, but it's basically an upgraded Formula 4 car, but we'd consider it kind of at that level because drivers from there tend to go straight to FIA Formula 3. It does mean that you know, there's just simply not enough space in the top 50 when we already had the champion there. And we already had Behrmann, who did a bit of GB3 as well as F4. So simply just a case of not enough space. That's pretty much it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I suppose now's a good time to talk about a couple of Formula 2 drivers who didn't quite make the top 50. Perhaps one of the unluckiest drivers of the year, Marcus Armstrong. He missed out on a top 10 spot. I probably would have placed him 11th in my top 10 Formula 2 drivers, and I probably would have placed him 51st in my top 50 as well. So Alejandro, Marcus Armstrong, painfully unlucky this year. A lot of times he did win a race, but ultimately what was expected to be a sideways set at best to Dams turned out to not be a particularly strong year for the Ferrari Junior.
I expected a lot more from Marcus, to be fair. I mean, after his tough year, because it was a very tough year with AFT last season, I expected him to really bounce back like Aiken did when he moved from ART to Campos back in 2019, but he didn't. I mean, he had moments where he showed his talent, like that move in Monaco on Darubala to get pole position or to get to the front row, but then he failed to start the race. And many others where he just disappeared. I don't know. We already saw last season that the Dan's car wasn't the very best with Dan fixing at the wheel, and things didn't really improve this year. So it was always going to be very difficult for Marcus, and despite he showed potential at some points, he was running quick and some great pace. In my opinion, he lacked a bit. That's perhaps why he missed on our top 50, sorry.
Yeah, there were certainly stronger second year drivers. I felt across the board which have made the top 50 in various places throughout. They're quite nicely spread out, I think, this year, the F2 drivers. Perhaps they'll be even a bit more spread out once we finally decide on Hauger versus Porsche. But another F2 driver I do want to bring up is Christian Lundgaard, who, another driver, very, very unlucky this year. Seems to have inherited the luck of the second ART driver, if you will, and just seemed to have a miserable year across the board when he wasn't driving in an IndyCar. So, Roger, fair to leave Lundgaard out this year after being so impressive as a rookie last year?
Yeah, I think you have to leave him out just because, as you said, because the results just weren't there, and it was a mixture of bad luck getting involved in too many incidents. I lost count of how many time penalties he accumulated during the year, and it just seemed to go from one disaster to another effectively, and I'm sure that wasn't all his fault. So just on the performance and when you see what his teammate is doing with the car, then I find it very difficult to rate him. In terms of talent, then I think we would all agree he would be comfortably in that list and potential, and hopefully, you know, he can demonstrate that going forward. But and the one-off he did in IndyCar, you know, I think we were all rooting for him probably, but I just struggled to have any idea where to put him, and I because of what happened in all the races, and I think it's fair to leave him out.
Mm-hmm, for sure. Let's talk about a couple of FIA3 drivers who missed out. Obviously, there are a lot of FIA3 drivers this year, and a lot of them obviously missed the grade. It would have been very, very easy to have just filled the top 50 with F2 and FIA3 drivers this year, but of course, some of them have got to to miss out. Well, I mean, Alessio De Leda was never going to make the top 50 this year, that's for sure. But quite a lot of drivers missed out for sure. One driver who I was impressed with at times this year, but just perhaps not on a regular enough basis, was Johnny Edgar. Did some pretty good stuff with Carlin, but could have even perhaps won a race at Hungary if not for a technical issue. But Bethany, quite fair to have Edgar missing the top 50 this year, even if he did have a few performances that flew a little bit under the radar this year.
Yeah, I think given there were so many really talented drivers, you needed to get up there. He just really didn't have that consistency. Even I feel like if we had a thing of who had the best kind of under the radar drives, he'd be up there, but he didn't. And I feel like there was probably a bit more expected of him. When I went back to do the list, I was like, oh, I'm sure he's done really well. And then looking back, it's like, no, he didn't do that great. So that's why he missed out on my list, just because of kind of like that falling below expectations. So I think that's, again, he's another driver with lots of potential who will probably be back in the top 50 soon, but not this year.
Mm-hmm, for sure. And we've even had a Premier FIA3 driver not quite make the grade this year in Ollie Caldwell, a race winner this year, of course. And his race pace generally wasn't too bad, but he just lacked the qualifying and the same sort of overtaking nous that his teammate showed. Premier perhaps didn't necessarily have the best package this year in FIA3, but at worst it was second best, and to finish eighth in the championship, I think it was, in a second year with that package, just wasn't quite impressive enough. There wasn't enough shown on the Sunday races to quite make it, but he's one of those drivers who was certainly in the discussion for a top 50 spot. Didn't quite make the grade, but who knows? Could make it in the future, especially if an F2 graduation full time comes off next year. I'll come to Ida for this next one, because it's a driver who perhaps if that championship ran later in the year, we may have thought about it a little bit more, and that's Enzo Trulli, a driver you were talking about just on the Year in Review podcast fairly recently, but a driver who perhaps had the unfortunate distinction of winning a championship so early in the year that everyone's perhaps forgotten about him in what's been such a crazy year.
Yeah, pretty much the case. Trulli was obviously the son of Monaco Grand Prix winner Jarno, so he had all that experience to go off. But he only started testing in F4 fairly late last year. Then he did F4 UAE, and it wasn't with like the usual big teams like XL Motorsport. It was with Pram, which is a bit of a strange choice when you go into the UAE. But he then won that title on the last lap of the race, against Delano Van't Hoff. And then what happened from there was Van't Hoff went to Spanish F4 and he dominated. And therefore, when we're talking about like F4 champions, even on occasion, I've accidentally called Van't Hoff the UAE champion, because in my memory, he started the year very well in F4, then he dominated Spain. Trulli instead went to Euro Formula with Drivex, which was, I'll admit, a team that was off the pace. He did get a podium in the first round, but by that point, his stock kind of drops because the team wasn't there. He couldn't show what he'd shown in F4. And by the time he switched to Carlin and he was in a car that could fight at the front, all the focus was on other drivers in the series, and what Trulli was doing wasn't really recognised, particularly when he was in a one-car team. But I think the fact that he did have a surname, Trulli, as well, you would expect a lot more attention on his results. So it was particularly underwhelming that not even that kind of helped him out there. I'll mention two other drivers who kind of suffered from the same fate. Although Pierre-Louis Chavez did get in our top 50, he kind of hassled Guan Yu Zhou all the way to the Asian F3 title, then was supposed to go to FIA Formula 3, but the budget, his sponsor basically snaked him, I'll put it that way. Travel Planet jumped ship to Jonathan Hoggard, which is a bit rude of them, after one round. So we didn't get to see Gervais' performances throughout the rest of the year at all. So we don't really know how quick he would have been. And then down in New Zealand, while everyone else was quarantining and stuff, they got to do the Toyota Racing Series. And the big story of that series was Shane Van Gisbergen, who is like 6'4", supercars legend at this point, going over there, jumping back into single seat. He couldn't fit in it at all. Like, it was horrifically painful for him to drive it. And he won the New Zealand Grand Prix from the back, I think from the pit lane as well. So all of the kind of news that we got from that series was focused on him, when in reality, a fresh from karting 16-year-old, Matthew Payne, who was like very close to Liam Lawson. At the time, Lawson was like shouting about how good Payne was. And Payne won, I think, all but one race that Van Gisbergen wasn't there. He took all of the pole positions as well. And then since then, he's been scouted by, there's no F1 teams in Australia, but supercars teams. They want him as one of their enduro drivers for 22. He went and did Porsche racing with Al Bamba support. So all of the biggest names in Down Under Motorsport are following him very closely, but he hasn't sat in a single seater since his TRS title. So you can't, you know, put him into our top 50 based on essentially 5 weekends at the very start of January against, admittedly, some really good opposition like Chris van der Drift and Van Gisbergen. But for 3 of those weekends, or 2 of those weekends, it was like 4 other cars. And that really kind of lessened the achievement of what he did, which is remarkable, because that was a Formula Regional Series. He had no single-seater experience and he turned up and he looked like a total pro.
Yeah, for sure. And I think we all hope that TRS sort of like goes back to having such a strong, well-rounded field again in the near future. But I guess we'll see on that front. Another driver got written down is Devlin DeFrancesco, and I've written him because he is moving up to IndyCar next year. He's one, I think, very, very few of us put anywhere near the top 50, but he's a driver who certainly deserves being mentioned. I think for me in particular, there were just too many rookies that were far stronger out there, particularly Kyle Kirkwood, and I just don't think it was quite a strong enough performance across the year. I don't think he won a race either in lights this year. So probably would have made somewhere in my top 150 or so, but I'm not entirely sure whereabouts. But he certainly deserves being mentioned there. Another driver that I want to come to Ida to is Kiffin Simpson, a Formula Regional champion as well. You spoke about him on the podcast the other day as well, but he missed out on the top 50 despite an interesting backstory and having very, very good results in a regional championship this year.
Yeah, Bethany said that she had Devlin in her top 50, so that was the one person I think who voted for him. So Kiffin is 16, I think, as well. He did USF4 last year, absolutely nowhere, totally off the pace, back of the grid. You wouldn't even notice he was in the championship. It was that kind of back of the grid performance. But then he moved up to Formula Regional Americas with the new TJ Speed team, which is run by Tim Neff, Aussie engineer. Everyone in America rates him very highly. And yeah, he started the season in absolute style in wet conditions. And then from there, kind of really matured. And this, I guess you do mature very quickly kind of at that age, more like a sponge. And he won the title. And with that, he got a 500K scholarship from Honda to go to Super Formula. But he turned that down. He's going to go to Indy Lights instead with TJ Speed. They're going to move into the series with him. And all in, like, that's a huge achievement to turn around such a bad 2020, and a bit like Jamie Chadwick as well, to then come back and win a title in 2021. But historically, you know, we do try and rate the Road to Indy series quite highly, but Formula Regional Americas, the quality really isn't there in that series besides He had one good rival this year, which was Ernie Francis Jr., and he was a single-seater rookie. But he was also like a seven-time sports car champion, so not easy to kind of tell what his true level of ability was. Then there was other regional series as well. Yuga Furutani won the Japanese series, and again, that was very small grids. Yao Paulo de Oliveira, who's a Super Formula champion, I think, he actually got called in to do a bit of running in that series to kind of help bring the numbers up. And one of the Aston Martin sports car teams even did like a prize thing because they really needed more cars on the grid. And watching those races, not much to say really about Furutani, totally under the radar. Bethany did try a lot through this year to try and get hold of Nico Prost, who won the Ultimate Cup Series Formula Regional Championship. But Nico Prost is already a former race winner and all that, so he obviously was not in contention at all for the FS Top 50. I'm trying to think if there are any other countries with Formula Regional Series. I think we've covered them all off. But a lot of them are very obscure. Next year with the Gen 2 Formula 4 car coming in, or tomorrow with the Gen 2 F4 car coming in, and there's going to be a lot more similarities to the Formula Regional cars, and we're expecting to see some of the older chassis, because a lot of them are being bought by Prema and by Mumbai Falcons and stuff, the Indian Championship, and go to America as well, because although they've got the Ligier car, they want more drivers, basically want to learn in the European car so they can then continue their career in Europe after they've done USF4. So we might see even more like Formula Regional Series, Formula 4 Series, all that kind of stuff in 2022, and it's just going to make it even harder, more like diluted, to see how high the quality actually is in those championships.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Formula Regional Japan, our favorite championship on the Formula Scout podcast to talk about. The final two drivers I've got on this list, we'll cover them off very quickly, and that's Noah Stromstad and Mads Ho. Stromstad sort of just came in and just absolutely blew the Danish F4 field away. All of a sudden, highly unexpected, but really, really quick. And Mads Ho won the championship in a Formula 5 car, which is an impressive feat in itself. But I think essentially because it's such a clubby level championship, that's probably the reason why they've missed off. It's another championship that we're just not entirely sure of how strong the field is across the board. So those are the sort of the names that I've picked out for drivers who are close to making the top 50, or some perhaps a little bit further afield from making the top 50, but very, very good years from all of them nonetheless. So I suppose just to sort of conclude, I'll go around to each of you and get your final thoughts on our top 50s this year. So Bethany, I'll come to you first. Your final thoughts on this year's top 50?
I think it's good. It's good to have so many different voices and people who have been focusing on different championships, because I think that's something that we've kind of missed out on the past couple of years. There's so many championships trying to compare them to one another, trying to make sure we don't forget America exists and Japan exists and things like that. And I feel like we've got a good balance this year of all the different series and trying to make sure that we don't put too much emphasis on Monaco.
Yes, for sure. Roger, it's your first top 50 with Formula Scout. How do you rate taking part in it this year?
Very, very enjoyable. I must admit, I was quite surprised how little disagreement there was. Apart from probably second place is probably where we've disagreed the most, and maybe somewhere around 48, 49, 50. But generally, the opinions haven't been too far apart, which was, as has been said, you know, the differences between the championships, who's followed them, and really comparing, I don't know, Formula Regional in Japan with Formula 2 or you know or Indy Lights or whatever, you know, there's a huge difference. And it is, I found very difficult in that sort of the middle levels to really put an order. I think it's difficult to separate experience, potential, and performance in the year. That there are some who've obviously done very well this year and have knocked up win after win, but have been around for a little bit longer, and that makes it quite hard. But yes, looking forward to 2022.
Mm-hmm. And Alejandro, it's your first top 50 as well. With us, how have you enjoyed this experience?
Well, I'm not sure if I enjoyed it. I mean, I enjoyed it because it's something nice to do, but it's a very, very difficult task, putting all the drivers in order, because as Roger just said, there are many things you have to consider, as the experience, the potential, how their teams are performing. You've got lots of factors you have to take into consideration. And it is very difficult to give a fair order, because you never know if you are giving each factor the right importance. So it's been very, very difficult. I think we've done a fair choice. I mean, we'll see what the audience say, but I think we've been fair. And yeah, definitely we've had in the top 50 those who deserved it the most. When you come to the lowest positions, it's much more difficult, because there are those margins where you have to decide whether to give more importance to being higher up in a lower quality field, or you are in the midfield of a very high quality field, like if FIA Formula 3, for example, as you said, with Johnny Edgar and Ollie Caldwell, who both missed out in this top 50, and they had a very, very good first half of the year, and then fade away. So, yeah, I think we've done a fair list, and definitely I enjoyed doing it. It's been difficult, but it's been good.
Mm-hmm. I'll give the penultimate word to Ida. You've taken part in several of these top 50s now. How does this one rank among the others that you've taken part in?
Probably the one with the least arguments in. Like the easiest ones to make the decisions of the drivers who are in like the top 25. And obviously the number one spot was obviously going to go to one driver this year. We all voted for that same driver. I still feel a little sour over Patricia O'Ward not getting in the top 10 several years ago. I'll never let go of that. But I think this year as well was kind of like a premium year for junior single seaters in terms of like racecraft, and you know, we didn't really have too many farcical races where, you know, you had like the safety car out every lap and things like that, whereas in previous years we did have series which were really badly inflicted by bad driving standards and just chaotic crashes and things like that, whereas, you know, we just had highly competitive action in a lot of championships this season. Sometimes it wasn't, you know, the most entertaining, and therefore it didn't impress us, and it therefore didn't, like, you know, take into consideration for the top 50. But there wasn't like a series where, you know, we looked at that series briefly and went, oh, none of those drivers deserve to be in the top 50 if we had followed that series closely, whereas in previous years we kind of had that consideration. But yeah, I think this one's been the most peaceful one to do, and kind of the easiest in that context as well, despite there being even more racing than ever before to cover off.
I think part of that is because we didn't have the time to argue so much about it, because of how late the Formula 2 season finished in particular, just a couple of weeks ago now. It feels quite crazy to think about, really. And so we had to really make sure we were really efficient with this one, and certainly I think there has been a lot less arguing than in previous years, but it's been really good to take part in this one this year. I also feel a little bit sort of gah, if only, about Pato not quite making the top 10 all those years ago, but I think with Kyle Kirkwood, it's certainly more than justified this year. So yeah, this year's been a lot of fun. I would have quite liked a little bit more competition over P1, but I think at the same time it just shows how good our top spot driver has been this year and how impressive he has been. That he gets such a coveted position so easily without such debate at all. So that's really good, and I hope that the drivers in the top 10, certainly the Formula 2 drivers, pay attention to where they've placed this year, because not always been easy to rate those drivers. Same with FIA 3 drivers with the format that we have had this year. So really, really good top 50, I think, this year, and some very, very good drivers across the board, as Ida's already pointed out. Really, really strong crop of drivers in a lot of places, and some very, very good drivers not quite making the grade this year, which just showcases the quality of the junior single seater landscape at the moment. So that's very, very good, and I look forward to seeing where a lot of these drivers end up in the near future. So that brings an end to what is finally the final podcast of the year, at least it being recorded. We haven't quite worked out when exactly this one's going out yet, but it's been an incredible top 50, an incredible year, some incredible races, incredible drivers, incredible driving, and incredible overtakes, incredible work output, incredible podcasts, incredible guests, incredible everything, I think, with Formula Scout this year. Incredible numbers in terms of reads on the website, social media follows, and so forth. So it's been quite a remarkable year across the board. Top 50 has been quite remarkable as well. So that brings an end to 2021 as a whole. Enjoy your New Year's celebrations, however you may do them in a safe manner, if you can, please, and we look forward to hearing from everyone in 2022, and we look forward to getting some racing underway, well, very, very soon, hopefully, with action not far away at all. So I've been Craig Willard. Everyone else has been everyone else. And we'll be back next year with another Formula Scout podcast.